Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 25th in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive through questions posed to the participants an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today, we are talking about social media. And with us today is Michelle Overstreet for the first time, back against Sarah Welton and Michelle Church. So my first question, and we started talking about this a little bit out in the lobby before we got on the recording, is that can we make a list of some of the entities that would qualify as social media? Like, what is social media? What do we use as examples for social media? I started the list, but I just want to check it off here, see if you guys have the same thing. Michelle, what do you think?
Well, I think we started with texting. You know, with the early cell phones, people were texting, and I think that was sort of the beginning, and it's evolved over time, so we're now...
But even before that, there was emails, right?
There were emails,
yeah. That would qualify as well, right? Okay.
Okay. Facebook, of course, is something that I have learned about and participate in on a daily basis.
I'm looking at your list here. So Twitter, Instagram, all of those things. It started out with...
I noticed you stopped at the dating sites and the porn sites.
I couldn't read that. I couldn't read your rating on there.
So let's talk about that a little bit. Dating sites and porn sites, would they qualify as social media as well?
Sure, I think so.
Okay.
I think the quote-unquote entertainment news programs like Fox and Friends also qualifies as social media.
Okay, news... opinion sites. Mm-hmm. How about chat rooms? Do they still exist? The chat rooms still go.
And I think that's social media. That's a place where people gather to exchange
people, blogs.
Blogs.
I mean.
And your daughter mentioned Pinterest, which I didn't know.
Pinterest.
Okay, I guess that's something new for me, but I can put that on the list. Anything else?
Well,
go ahead, Sarah.
Within your Facebook, you have all the groups that you can belong to, or you ask questions.
We're going to talk about that. But you would say that there's like subgroups of social media just in Facebook.
Yes.
Okay, what about WikiLeaks? Would you say that's a social media thing or not?
I think anything that is tied to a computer... or the internet, so that an audience that can be reached extends beyond your circle of friends. I think all of that qualifies as social media.
Every website there is, basically, what you're saying. Okay. All right, let's talk about let's talk about Facebook. Do you all have Facebook accounts?
Yes.
Okay, you all do. Good. Mm-hmm. How much time daily do you spend on Facebook? Michelle, we'll start with you.
I would guess that I spend somewhere between a half an hour and an hour, but I'm very focused. I run the My House Facebook page and about four other pages that are connected to that in addition to my own personal one. So I don't do a lot of personal stuff.
So what kind of pages do you say other pages?
Well, My House is a nonprofit, and then I have a Gathering Grounds Cafe, which is one of the businesses we run that trains homeless kids, and a steam-driven boutique, same thing. It's a boutique that trains homeless kids, so I run all three of those with help from the youth that are employed there. And then Opiate Task Force page. I'm a administrator on that page, so I'm adding things to that. So I try to have a time frame that I work through, and I'll say, okay, these are the things that are my priorities today. Spend that amount of time. If I go over the time, then it has to wait.
So Facebook is very business-centric.
For me, it is, yes. Yeah, for me, it is.
Okay, Sarah, how much time do you spend on a day?
I probably spend a half an hour to an hour. It depends on what's happening. I keep up with my daughter in the Seattle area. I keep up with the church happenings in our region, which is located mostly in the Pacific Northwest, so I'm getting information from, you know, 40 different churches, maybe 50 at a time. I also am...
You get all that done in a half hour to an hour?
Right.
Well,
yeah.
It depends on, you know, sometimes only, you know, two churches might have posted something or something else like that. You don't get it all at once. Sometimes people will blog for the whole region and get information from 5-10 different churches and put it out there at one time. And so I'll read that. I have grandchildren, so I'm going to be checking up on any of their happenings. And those aren't...
They have their own Facebook accounts?
No, they don't, but their parents do. Okay. And I keep up with some really close friends whom I've met on Facebook. In fact, when I was in Atlanta, I met a woman that I met on Facebook 3 years ago. We actually met face to face. It was just a fantastic time. And so there are times that I'm spending more time because I'm trying to coordinate things, or time when I'm just trying to catch up. I have cousins on the East Coast, and once in a while they'll post a whole bunch of stuff, and I'll keep up with them.
Michelle?
Well, it varies depending on what the time of year it is. So now, because it's summer and with the farm, I'm not on Facebook as much as I am in the winter. Facebook can be a total black hole that you can disappear into for hours at a time if you're not careful. And so, and I have been known to be a, as my son calls it, an overposter. Because I, you know, people post things that I find interesting or I agree with, or maybe I disagree with or whatever. And then I share that. And so
you repost it.
Right. That's the whole, you know, social media kind of aspect of it.
Okay. That's my next question. Do you post anything? So Sarah, what do you post?
A lot of times it's just posting pictures of Alaska. I will repost items of interest that come from the political realm that I wish to question or ask if anybody else agrees. Books, you know, when somebody says, I read this fantastic book, and if I have read it, then maybe I'll add on to that. There's a lot of times people will post questions, you know, what's your favorite foods, and list, you know, five things and stuff like that. Sometimes I do that. It's interesting. I have met people over that Facebook, and I've kept up with friends through that. I will repost, you know, sometimes little memes that I find interesting. And of course, right now, I can't come up with one off the top of my head. But there's some pretty funny things that people will post, pictures, questions, some old stories and jokes, poems, things like this. And I will repost the things that are meaningful to me.
Michelle, you repost?
I do. I do. A lot of the times between our businesses, we share information. If it's on the weekend and I'm, you know, taking some time for my personal page, and similar to Sarah, I'll post things that I think are interesting or that I want to develop a conversation around. Sometimes I kind of have fun posting things that are political just to see what the response is, you know, who's thinking about things in a similar way, or what other opportunities for input there are. With the opiate task force page, there ends up being a lot of things that are I call them passively political. We're posting them because they're relevant to the opiate epidemic and to issues that are local to our community, but a lot of times they'll go nationwide as a political cause. So
this goes to my next question about learning things from Facebook. So you have to agree that you learn quite a bit from Facebook.
Sometimes I do. I think you have to check your sources and you know, really kind of monitor the feed for actual facts. There are a lot of people have opinions, but with the opiate page, for example, we post a lot of research-based, outcome-based information that's useful for people who are dealing with friends or family that are trying to get clean and sober, what works and what doesn't work kinds of information. And there's new every day. Every day there are new things coming out. So,
and Sarah, you said already that you learn a lot of things from Facebook.
Yes, and I keep up with information about the psychology, you know, which is my field, and education. Lots of good information. And, of course, as Michelle said, you had to check your sources. Sometimes pop psychology shows up as being fact, and then you start to really look at it, and it goes, oh, well, somebody really liked this idea, but they don't have anything to back it. And it's one of those things. You have to be careful, and this is, you know, part of the education system is to teach people to look at what your sources say. Where does it come from? If this is somebody's opinion and you like the opinion, great, but don't buy it as 100% truth, and that there's, you know, something more to look at. Maybe a whole research could be done on that topic.
Michelle, you talked a couple things about your son saying that you overposted.
Yeah.
And also the black hole you mentioned. You want to give us some more details
right.
about that?
Well, you can get just sucked into reading these articles, and then if you are being diligent about trying to trace to see, you know, where does this come from, that leads you down other potential rabbit holes that you might.
How can you make that check? I'm not on Facebook, so I don't. You know, I'm learning all about this from you three.
So, well, I look at the, I guess it's the URL or of the Facebook post. Sometimes they reference different things. You can go to Snopes to, so you leave Facebook and you go into a different medium to verify those facts on whether something is false or not.
And you can actually get true verification by going there?
Well, you know, I think there's some argument on, you know, how accurate Snopes is, or, you know, some of the other, you know, that's sort of it's the flip side of the coin. Everything that human beings do, I think, has this yin and yang thing to it. So social media is great in that you can contact people, you can meet people that there's no way you'd ever meet before without that medium. But you can also be very misled, which, you know, of course, the last election certainly has that in the spotlight. So you have to be careful, but it's easy to not be careful because it's easy to be lazy with social media, because you can look at it and go, oh, I agree with that or whatever, and then you share it and then you find it. And I do this. This happens to me if I'm doing something and I have a few minutes and I'm waiting for somebody or whatever, and I check and I see something that I think, oh my gosh, that cannot be. What is going on with this or whatever? And then I'll share it, and then someone else will say, yeah, that's not correct. So,
You segued into the next question, which is, do you see any potential danger in it? You've already mentioned something.
Oh, definitely.
Sarah, do you see any danger?
Well, there's people will request my friend to be a friend on Facebook, and I'll have no idea who they are, where they came from. And, you know, some people will say, well, you know, this person sounds interesting. I'll go ahead. And it turns out to be, you know, a fake picture and a fake profile and everything like that. And so
how did you determine that it was fake?
Well, you look around and see if there's any way that person could have known you in some way. And if there's no connection, you delete it. You immediately delete it. That's one of those things. And I've had that happen. And then I went into my Facebook account measures and did a thing where they don't allow those posts to come to me anymore. people that aren't connected to me in any way. And so that's how I can take care of that. But there's a lot of stuff that gets sent out to me that has to do with, you know, the science behind some psychology, and it's total fake. There's something about, you know, how crystals will help you do this and that and the other thing. And there's
believe in that.
Yeah. So you all have the crystals.
There's magical ways to lose weight, you know, and boy, we would love them. And that's why they get the focus and attention, you know, is that you can take off pounds in 2 days. You can do all this kind of stuff. And, we go back to the advertising and learning about truth in advertising. I'm really, really hoping that more time is spent at school to really work with our students and our kids to discern what is, you know, the truth in the advertising, and what is advertising that is very misleading, things like that, as well as, you know, the posting, because we're not just getting posts, we're getting advertising.
Michelle, any dangers you've encountered with Facebook?
Well, I think there's a lot of misinformation. Doing a lot of work with the Opiate Task Force in my house, which is a youth-oriented agency, we're really thoughtful about drug posts about, you know, drugs that are being used for treatment, drugs like marijuana that have been legalized socially, but there are still a lot of questions about long-term impacts or some of the addictive pieces to that. And I think we have to really be thoughtful and cautious looking at the demographic you serve as well. So
this is Bridging the Gap on KVRF. Today we're talking about social media with Michelle Overstreet, Sarah Welton, and Michelle Church. I'm going to move on from Facebook to Twitter here for a second. Should Trump's tweets be considered as executive directives, non-binding opinions of a raving lunatic, or somewhere in between those two extremes? Trump's tweets. How are we to take them?
Let's see. So I don't do Twitter, for one thing, just because I don't even understand how people have time to do that, because your phone must be dinging all the time, and you would be constantly distracted to see who tweeted what. So I signed up for a Twitter account because I thought, oh, that might be interesting. And then I never went any further with it because it just seemed like too much to me. As far as Trump goes, I mean, he has taken the presidency to, entirely new lows, I think. I don't think any president has ever voiced his opinions or whatever in any manner as flippantly as he does with Twitter. Because of it is the presidency, I do think that what he says has more impact, and so he needs to be held accountable to what he is tweeting. I don't think Congress much takes what he's saying as a policy directive, but it confuses everybody because normally when a president says something or puts something in writing, which a tweet is something in writing, mm-hmm. It has meaning. And so therefore, you know, people are sort of always in this tailspin as to whether it is a policy directive or if it's going to turn into a policy directive or if it is just simply the ravings of a lunatic.
Sarah?
So that I don't do Twitter. My daughter does. I see the retweets of what President Trump has on Facebook, mm-hmm. and also in, you know, the late night comedians always are talking about those things. And I would like for our president to not do that. He's going to do it. So what do I do? I have to just say it's there. I can't. I don't want to say it's not his right to do those things, but I think that it hurts America a lot of times. And, you know, we all still wonder what that COFEFE thing was. So that's all I have to say on that.
I am on Pinterest, or I am on Twitter, and so are several aspects of our social media for our nonprofit and the ancillary organizations. We have it set up so that I can push one button, and if I share a Facebook page or a Facebook post, it automatically tweets it. So I like that because it's time-saving and it's practical, and a large number of the young people we serve pay attention to that. If they see something that comes up from my house or from myself, they'll you know, respond back to that. So I like...
You're basically talking about responsible use of Twitter.
Well,
that's not really what the question was.
Yeah,
the question was Trump's use of Twitter.
Well, you know, he's the president. He gets to do whatever he wants. He gets to do it how he wants. And
as you do.
I don't have to like it.
I mean, you make a choice.
I don't have to like it. I like Sarah, I wish he had a better bedside manner, although bedside isn't the word. I wish he had a better social awareness. But I feel like there are pieces of that that connect to a younger generation that is not me. And the perception that they have is different. The outbursts for them are more normal, and they're not as dramatic as they are for someone my age. They have the ability to take it as a grain of salt. It's not as impactful for a younger generation.
And so you're saying the younger ones don't feel as take it as seriously as we do?
I don't think they do. I think they have the ability to go, yeah, you know, sometimes I say stuff on there I don't mean, or I put something when I'm mad. And I think it's different. I think those of us who didn't have that as youth are more thoughtful. When we put something in writing, it's meaningful. And I think there's an odd shift there that's interesting.
Generational.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I noticed about some observations is that once a post initiates a topic, and I'm generally getting this from my Steelers, that's all I get on is the Steelers, is that comments below that follow a lot of times deteriorate into hate-filled rants loaded with insults. Is that your experience? That comment sections of a post can degenerate into that?
I think so, and I think that's where a lot of the so-called trolls or the bots, as they're called, are sort of a certain comment or a certain topic, certain words or whatever will trigger these robotic people. And I don't know how all of it works, and I don't want to know. But you can sort of tell when some of the comments sort of veer off into this very negative ranting type of dialogue, that it's almost designed to get more people riled up. So
so that's the purpose.
It's the purpose.
Generate anger.
Right.
Sarah, I see you nodding there.
When I look at articles that are posted, and then I look at the responses, sometimes they're all, very positive, and then there'll be a whole list of real negative nastiness, things like that, and you go, where did that come from? How did anybody get that from this? And it could be that one word triggered, the computer to spit out stuff. I don't know. I'm not familiar with all the bots and stuff. I do know that there are people who do the trolling, and I know that that does occur.
So are you saying that the negativity comes from the bots as opposed to real people in order to start something up?
I don't know, but I have the feeling that some of it is. I have the feeling that some of it is that a certain word or word sequence will trigger that response. Maybe it's send a message to somebody to say, hey, you need to respond to this person, that kind of thing, in a negative way. I would assume that it probably works the other direction too. That if somebody has a lot of positive things to say, and there seems to be a lot of negative in an article, somebody might get that. I don't know how it all works, but I know that it can, and I've seen some peculiar responses to things that had nothing to do with the topic, And you just go, oh, where did that come from?
Were those responses more on the emotional?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Michelle, any comments on the comment section?
Well, I think that when Sarah talked about the subgroups on Facebook, I think the administrator has the ability to sort of determine a lot of the tone. And some of them really enjoy having a big controversy and something stirred up all the time. I don't know that it's triggered by any necessarily outside influences, but a lot of times it's people sort of advocating for their own political agendas while trying not to appear to do so.
So you mentioned the administrator.
Mm-hmm.
What does the administrator do? What is the role of the administrator?
When you have a Facebook page or a group, there's one person or a small group of people, 3 to 4, that are sort of the supervisors of that. And
are they
can
employees
leave.
Of Facebook?
No. They're people that started the group. Or for me, the Opiate Task Force is a great example. I'm an administrator. Michael Carson is administrator. John Green is an administrator. So the three of us put posts up there and decide what stays and goes. And we're all really compatible in terms of what we like to stay and what we like to go.
Okay, are there any administrators beyond, say, a business or an organization like some friends have administrators, or is that just...
Usually when you set up a Facebook page, you designate who has access to add or delete things from the page, and only those people have the ability to do that.
So the person who sets up the page becomes the administrator with the power.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or the group.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Alex Jones was recently booted off a number of platforms, but not Twitter. I think he was given a 1 week suspension on Twitter. Yeah. Do restrictions to platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram constitute a violation of the First Amendment, right to free speech?
I don't think so. I think that from my perspective, and keeping in mind that I work with a youth age group, there are, like Sarah said, there are, and Michelle, there are people who are always watching for something to criticize, condemn, complain about. And there are also vulnerable people who are lonely, who are sometimes seeking help with the Opiate Task Force page. We see that.
You mentioned earlier about suicides, the potential mm-hmm, for suicides.
Mm-hmm, the potential for suicides. We had a Narcan training where my organization trains people to use Narcan kits so that if they come into contact with someone who's in an overdose state, they can literally save their lives. And we had people who posted on there underneath a parent saying, "Thank God this drug was here. It saved my son's life." We had people posting underneath that saying they should have let him die. You know, what a waste of time, what a waste of money. These losers need to just be allowed to die. And we removed some of those. That's harmful and it's hurtful. And, you know, the children in our community and young adults who are addicted, I believe, should get a second chance. We shouldn't just say, take them out. But so that's an
Does
example.
Does everybody agree that harmful things should be restricted from social media and that someone should have the power to make that restriction?
I think somebody has to be able to have that ability. I think Facebook, in whatever their algorithm is, I don't think they do a great job. I think maybe it is a purposeful, not doing a great job kind of a thing.
What do you mean? Why would it? What's their motivation?
Well, because it's like they say that Facebook isn't the product. We are the product. The users are the product of Facebook. And so they make their money through advertising. The more, you know, they have always said that anytime your name is in the paper, it's a good thing. Good or bad, people are going to remember that. And so I think that Facebook sort of falls under that kind of a belief. I think they're being called out on it now because of, you know, the seeming problems with the election. So, yeah, I mean, it's a fine line, but, you know, it's a different line that we're walking now because there is such I mean, we used to be able to transfer information only by horseback. It took weeks to get, you know, and not very long ago, really.
A lot faster with the Pony Express.
Right, you know, and now it's like seconds. You could have something that's spread all over the world. So it's quite a difficult thing that they've created, but I think that whoever is much smarter than I am needs to figure out a way to ferret out the truly harmful and purposefully misleading stuff and be able to at least say this is misleading and this is why.
Sarah, restrictions pose any First Amendment violations?
I feel that we have to take that First Amendment and we have to understand the reason behind having the First Amendment. Putting it on Facebook or Twitter or things like this, we really need to have restraint. People can be hurt. It's that screaming fire in a crowded theater thing. I believe that we need to work with understanding why we have that First Amendment and then go into, okay, what else do we have the right to do? We don't have the right to harm people through this. We do not have that right.
Okay, here's a tough question for you. How do we balance the freedom to say anything we want with the need for civility? Or are we entering a post-civility era? Is social media accelerating the advent of the era, post-civility? Are we there? Are we heading into it?
Probably. I think we have been. I think that's up to us, the users, though, to sort of put the brakes on ourselves and to...
Individual personal responsibility.
I think that in the end, that's what it's going to come down to, because I don't know how you could control it otherwise. I mean, people need to realize that this is a tool, and as a tool, it can be used for good or it can be used for evil, and you need to make that determination yourself. I think there is great opportunity for... the lack of civility because of the anonymity that people have on Facebook and on these other social medias. And that, you know,
it
again,
protects them from accountability.
Right. They don't have, right. No, you can say things on a Facebook post that you would never say to that person in person. And so really, I do think that, you know, in school, I mean, when I was growing up in the dark ages, they did have, you know, civics classes, and part of the civics classes was how to be civil, because that's what civics was.
Sarah?
Well, having taught many psychology courses, social emotional learning, managing stress, working through assertiveness and the difference between being assertive and being aggressive and things like that, our society has the opportunity to learn those things, but we have been forcing and pushing that you need a career. Well, these other skills are exactly what's important as well. You can't keep a job if you can't be civil. So you do need to learn that skill as well. I find.
But what about Michelle's point that the anonymity
absolutely
has allowed people to be uncivil?
Absolutely. But we've also, that's the thing of moving from the movie theater to the home theater. How many of our kids that are under the age of 17 are watching our movies? I mean, I can't imagine, you know, that you're going to restrict your 11-year-old from an R movie today. I mean, they're going to see it somewhere. It's just the change in society. We may have these rules, but people aren't going to follow them.
Back to Michelle's point about personal responsibility.
Personal responsibility. But a part of it is the caring, making a caring society that parents care to teach their children these things. And that's, I'm finding it difficult for some people to want to teach their child to care, because then they have to model it and they don't want to. I'm seeing a lot of that. And that maybe I'm jaded in that area, but there are other people that go out of their way to make sure that their child is learning to have empathy and learning to care for others. So I made a generality, but I've seen an awful lot of the other where people don't care.
Michelle, social media accelerating our uncivil discourse?
Well, I think in some cases it is. I think there's a segment of the population that uses and abuses that. But I also think that there's a good lesson in there about discernment. And we talked about it before the show. My 13-year-old daughter has very, very little social media. She's not watched R-rated movies. She's a very thoughtful, caring young person. But she also, when she sees things like that, because sometimes I'll show her things that I think are outrageous and I'll say, what do you think about that? Because I want her to think critically and I want her to think in terms of how socially you treat other people. And she's really learning a lot about, you know, that person probably doesn't have the same values that I do. That person probably shouldn't be a person that I would take input from on anything. And I think there's a lesson there that the young people that are seeing that learn. I think there's an opportunity for really identifying who you want to be and who you don't be. We use that in our drop-in center. If you don't like the way that person is treating you, don't act like that.
Don't hang out with that person.
Don't hang out with them, for sure. But, you know, don't mirror that behavior. Don't act like that, because nobody really likes that. You're unemployable when you behave like that. We say that a lot in our building. If you behave like that, no one will employ you. You will look for a job forever and struggle with homelessness. You have to change your attitude. So there's some outcomes, some success outcomes that are dependent on learning to accept that personal responsibility that I think are real life that don't necessarily exist on the internet. Unless you just want to be blocked from all those sites, because that can happen.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF, Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. Today we're talking about social media with Michelle Overstreet, Sarah Weldon, and Michelle Church. Can any of you describe how the Russians used Facebook to try to help Trump win the presidency? Do you know the details of that, how that worked out? I think, Michelle, you do.
Well, you know, I don't know that I know the details. I know what I think are the details, or that seem obvious, that certain things happened. Well, I think that they did create fake accounts, and I think that they did create these bots that got people all riled up with different emotional tags. I think that they planted ideas in people's heads, and because, you know, not very long ago we used to be a society where if something was on the news or in the paper or whatever, you assumed that it was true, because you assumed, or I assumed, I guess, that there was some layer of accountability there, and I don't think that that's true. And I think that the Russians took advantage of that, and used it to really drive wedges between the community. So, you know, it's either you're with us or you're against us, and I don't think that as a society that is a workable thing, but it's a very effective thing, because then it does create this sense of camaraderie, and that, oh, there's all these people that think like me, and it's
and the people that think like that were led to links,
right,
of these websites. DC Leaks was one of the websites that the Russians put together.
Right, and they were fake. I mean, I just find it so ironic, you know, that, you know, coming from President Trump, you know, his use of the term fake news, it's like he calls out something that he helped create.
He himself is doing.
Right. You know, I mean, the reality TV shows, those are all fake. Everything is fake. But people, they glom onto it because it's the voyeurism. It's titillating or whatever. And so I think that what happened with the Russians and the election is they clamped onto that and they exploited it very, very effectively as far as dividing people.
Any more comments on? I didn't think. I knew I was going to get Michelle to talk about it.
Sorry. Girl.
Now, this question goes to all of you, though. Does knowing of Russian manipulation of Facebook, and we all know that everybody in the intelligence community has said they've done it, to get Trump elected, does that affect your own membership with Facebook, or does that have no effect on your being on Facebook? The fact that Russia has used Facebook to try to manipulate the election of 2016.
I think because we have become aware of that there are more safeguards in place.
Doesn't, in your mind, or in the platform?
In my mind, there are more safeguards, and I've been able to take advantage of some of the safeguards. Some of it works against some things that I like to do, but I find I think that understanding the responsibilities involved. It's everyone. It's just like the election. It's the voters that have to deal with things that happened. Okay, if there was manipulation, then the voters have to deal with that. That they have to say, okay, we're going to take control of this.
Michelle?
I think it again makes people more discerning and thoughtful about where they get information, and. The safeguards are great, but back to personal responsibility. Everybody has to be, you know, the old question authority. I think you have to be vigilant and aware of where you're getting your information.
Anything besides vigilance that you like to add?
Well, I mean, I think I found myself being very angry that I was used the way I was by Facebook. You know, I don't necessarily think that it's the Russians. I mean, the Russians obviously misuse this platform, but Facebook itself, Mark Zuckerberg, those guys, they have profited enormously from that, and I think that they are reluctant to really rein it in because
of the money.
Yeah, right. Because they can make a lot of money from it, and so I don't use Facebook as much as I used to because of that. I don't like to be used. I don't like to be manipulated. I don't like the cross contamination of what Facebook is able to glean from any site that you go to, any website, anything that you do online. If you look at something on Amazon or on one of these other websites that are linked commercially with Facebook, because they are, then all of a sudden you start seeing all of these things, and I don't like being followed like that. I don't like that feeling, and so
surveillance.
I've dialed it back quite a bit on Facebook. I use it more for our farm, for
the business
yeah. aspect of it, than
which is what Michelle does with her Facebook.
Right. Yeah. Then the social aspect. It's kind of like, you know what, Mr. Zuckerberg, you can have your little Facebook page. I'm not going to play anymore.
I'm with you. I'm not even on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Cyberbullying used to be confined to mean girls and jocks posting derogatory messages to nerds in high school they wanted to humiliate. Has our cyberbullying chief elevated the practice to a useful political tool? You ever know who the cyberbullying chief is? Okay. Is it a useful political tool? Has he elevated bullying? For that, you made hay from it.
I'm just gonna jump in because I hate silences. So, I think he's sort of normalizing the meanness that is so prevalent on social media, and I think that's really harmful for our country in the long run. I do think that he certainly leads by example, and he makes it okay for other people to jump in and do things that maybe they wouldn't have done otherwise, but they see him doing it and they think, you know, why not?
I guess the question I'm asking is the use of cyberbullying by Trump galvanizing his base kind of tool? Is that working for him the way he does it?
I believe because it seems more natural and normal. And one of the reasons that, you know, some people said they voted for Trump was because he was like the rest of us. And he's saying it. I can now speak my mind the way I wanted to. That I've heard that. To me, I'm offended by it. The way he is, I'm just offended by how that, the words, the language, and the attacks on people.
Is it working as a useful political tool?
I think if we say yes, then we're agreeing to the dumbing down of America. I think a lot of people recognize it for what it is. I think he's a great provocateur. He loves to have something stirred up all the time, and Twitter wars and all these strange terms that didn't exist 5 years ago. But I don't know that it's necessarily making cyberbullying acceptable. Again, I think the youth that I work with are more discerning. I think it makes them more aware. I think it makes them think about who they want to be and how they want to interact with people.
So it's acceptable to some, but it turns others off, mm-hmm. is what you're all saying.
Yeah.
What about Melania and her campaign against cyberbullying? What do you feel about that? Sarah, you have a disgusted look on your face.
It's not disgusted. It's just it's one of those, how in the world can you stand up and say, you know, I'm against bullying, I'm against the cyberbullying, and yet your spouse is doing it? I know that the need for someone to stand up against bullying is important. I don't know that she has much credence because of the way her husband has used Twitter.
Comments on Melania there?
Yeah, I think that was another one of those things where it's like, this is a bad thing. I mean, I don't know what her motives are, but I agree with Sarah. I don't think she's been particularly effective because her husband continues to name call at a very third grade level too. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of embarrassing that, you know, the president does that sort of thing, or that anybody does that sort of thing, but particularly the president of the United States to resort to name calling, and to name call other leaders, like, you know, Rocket Man. I mean, really, you know, whether or not, I mean, I certainly don't agree with North Korea's anything, but I just think that level of allowing name calling to be okay, I think it does give people permission to do that, and I think it does galvanize his base.
Should Melania tell Donald to knock it off, Michelle?
Well, I think between the two of them, probably yes, but I also don't think that you know, and keeping in mind that my frame is primarily drugs and alcohol in youth. And we can sometimes tell kids to do things all we want, and they don't do it. And your reference to childlike behavior is well taken. We can also tell our spouses what we want them to do and not do, and they don't have to respond in a way that's favorable to our requests. So I'm not sure that holding her responsible, in fact, I feel like holding her responsible for his behavior is like not holding him accountable. And so I don't care for that. I feel like they have to be separated. I don't think her voice is as strong because of that. But I do think it's an interesting juxtaposition where she's calling him out on something that everyone can see that he's doing. And I don't know, there's something very interesting for me about that in her. I there's a part of me that admires that because she's really saying to the rest of America, I see it. And there's a part of me that likes that. I admire that. I've been in meetings in this local community where people have called me names, well-known pastors, business leaders. behaved in a way that's very similar to that. I've experienced that as a community member here. And so it's not just the president. It's culturally, we have allowed men to behave that way, and particularly to women. And rather than saying this is an extension of something that happens in our culture, I think we really have to look at the bigger picture.
So what can women do to stop all these bad men from doing this stuff?
Well, I don't know that they're bad men, but I think that culturally we've allowed that.
I guess I should have used air quotes for bad.
Yeah, I don't know.
We're not all bad. Earlier in the hour, Mike wanted to add to the list of Wikipedia and Instagram. Is that what that note was about? Yeah, so those are all also social medias. Okay, after the massacre at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, the students there used social media to organize the Never Again movement. Mm-hmm. Clearly proved to be effective nationally, as we all observed in Washington, D.C. Who do you think are the most effective practitioners of the cyber medium? The army of Russian hackers employed by Putin or the Parkland students? Socially, politically.
I would have to say the Parkland students were because we could relate to them emotionally, socially. We heard all about the things. We're not related to the Russians, other than that they've invaded our social media and invaded our media. Period. I think that the social media, because we could make the connection, especially those of us who have children, we could make that connection.
I think the Parkland students, they killed it, man. They pun intended. They took the whole country by storm and made their statement, and they did it overtly. It wasn't covert. The thing that I find just reprehensible about the Soviet actions is that it was so covert, and when you get a group of youth that are passionate about something, it's awesome to see them successful.
So we have a lot more respect for those kids than those hackers.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I don't know that they're more successful though than the Russian bots, because
how can we tell? What can we use to measure whether they're successful?
Well, I think time will tell that, but I think that the Parkland students, they were speaking from a place of honesty and truth, and I think that the Russians or whoever are speaking from a place of manipulation and falsehood, and they don't really care what the outcome is. They're going to continue doing that, whereas the Parkland students are going to stay focused on what their mission is, and hopefully America's attention span will last as long as they do.
We have about 3 minutes left. What suggestions would you give to social media platforms, we made a list earlier, in the area of restrictions that would result in your mind as a better place than what we have now? Now, I know you already talked about personal responsibility, individual personal responsibility, but if you had the power to place some kind of restrictions on any of these platforms that would end up making things better than what we've seen, what would that be?
Well, personally, I think that they are able to tell. I mean, if I can ferret out whether or not something is fake news or is purposefully designed to ramp people up, I think Facebook can. And I think they need to call them out on it, and okay, then I think they need to cut them off.
Let me ask one detail about that. Would that require hiring more people, like more monitors?
Sure.
To do that?
Yep.
And that's what they could do. Sarah?
I said I agree, and I'm not trying to skate out of an answer here, but I agree that having that monitor and I would think that Facebook would want to say, we research, we look at, we will present something and maybe do like Snopes says, you know, at the, you know, this is mostly true, or this we found that this is false, and still present it, but have it marked.
Michelle, hire more monitors?
I don't know. I like being able to take people off and put on in individual circumstances, and I'd like to give an example. We had a young man who got clean and sober 6 years ago as a function of going through some pieces of our program and partners. And when we posted his 1 year sober celebration, people wrote on there, this guy's an a-hole, he'll never amount to anything. There were some really mean statements that were posted. And I didn't take him down without calling him. I called him and said, could you please look at that? My nature is that I want to remove those. And he said, don't do it. Don't do it. People need to understand that there's anger when you have somebody who's been an addict, but they need to see that I'm recovering. That guy has almost 6 years clean and sober now, but we can still go back and see those comments in his feed because he wanted them to stay there to represent that transition from addict to not addict. He started a company called Fiend to Clean to represent that. And there's a part of me that I really wanted to remove those. I did, because I didn't want him to be hurt. I didn't want it to be punitive. I didn't want him to be punished for stuff that happened over a year ago. But he used that to make a statement that was good. And I think if we start monitoring and taking out everything.
That statement might have been good for him as far as his personal odyssey and the challenges in front of him. But really, is it, you know, overall beneficial to see that kind of
Absolutely
stuff?
Absolutely it is, because there are a lot of people in the community that will say people don't recover, and people didn't believe that he would recover. And were able to voice that freely. That was their First Amendment. That was their freedom of speech, and to say that. And 6 years later, he can still come back on there and say, now I'm at 6 years. Do you remember when you made this comment?
It's kind of, I told you so.
It's what we're trying to do here is create a paradigm shift in the community where people really accept that people do recover. And in order to accept that, they have to understand where that person really came from. And it wasn't a Pollyanna journey. And to be able to look back on some of those things, to me, has value. It has not value not just for the addict, but for the whole community to be able to learn from that. So I guess I have some hesitancy on...
I guess my question is that nuance that you're exposing here, is that something that the community is really going to understand, or is it just more or less something that this individual is going to look at for strength?
Well, I think yes to both. I think he looks at it for strength, but I think there are a lot of people in the community doing battle with family members who are addicted, and part of their walk is that they have to work through the anger and get to a point where they believe that at least some people can recover. I think it's a journey that we are on as a community.
To me, I think the difference is all of those things are based on truth, different people's truths. There's a difference between that truth to an individual and something that is a purposeful manufacture of a lie and with intent to mislead. And that's what I'm talking about that needs to be monitored. I think that what you're talking about is absolutely valuable because it is all based on truth.
What a great synthesis. Panel, Michelle, Sarah, Michelle, thank you so much. Great discussion. And all you listeners out there in Radio Land, thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.